This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. The San Luis Obispo International Film Festival is coming up.
And you're going to see films that you might not see in a mainstream theater. They're just as worthy as any of those other big films.
Also, we'll learn about people's self-help housing and the affordable homes with site-based services.
The way to get them into a better place is to try to help address some of those situations that they found themselves in that led to them becoming homeless.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, April 8th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. A high school activist in Santa Maria is making waves fighting for farm worker rights. Cesar Vasquez started a youth-led organization last year that advocates for higher pay for the workers. It also provides workshops to teach the families new skills that would help them grow in different industries. KCBX's Gabriela Fernandez spoke with the Central Coast New Tech High School sophomore about his work and hopes for the future.
So, Cesar, to start off, are you from the Central Coast, and how did you get involved in local advocacy at such a young age?
So, I've always been involved with activism since eighth grade. I started off with different organizations in Santa Maria. I have lived in Santa Maria all my life. Both of my parents are actually field workers, so they pick and work in the strawberries. They always have, so I've always had to grow up with that, even if growing up with that meant that I didn't necessarily grow up with them. By the time I get home, they're already asleep because they wake up at 4 a.m. So I grew up here, and I was raised by them, but I wasn't ever really raised by them because they were always working the long hours, and when they got home, they weren't really there because, you know, like, if you're bending over all day and you're picking strawberries all day, you're not going to be mentally and physically there after work.
So if your mom and dad weren't home all day, then who led you to get involved in local policymaking?
So my sister, she was a part of an organization called Future Leaders of America and another one called Youth Making Change. And she told me to join in. From Future Leaders of America, I'd like helped with different organizations. And then because of that, I really felt the need for youth in the community. I felt the need for youth leaders. I created my own organization, which is entirely youth-led. My whole board is college and high school students, and we do all the work from organizing the workshops to getting grants to speaking to the public. Everything is us. The slogan that I really like to live my organization by is creating the next dreamers of the world, you know, and making sure that those dreamers don't stay dreamers, that they actually go on and live their life and fight for they want for what they want to fight for and go to the college and live the career that they want to. And I guess the start, well, not only the workshops, the start of all that is the fieldworker campaign that we're going to be working on next year.
How old are you again?
I'm 16. I'm a sophomore. I just turned 16 in December 23rd. So I got 15 and 16 mixed up a lot still.
So back to the fieldworker campaign, what is it and how did you know you wanted to work on something like that?
Well, the campaign I'm working on. So I should start off with the story of why it all started. Both of my parents are fieldworkers and I always had to live with that guilt and struggle of them working in the fields. And on Halloween, I took my sister to get a costume. We've never really had costumes growing up because we couldn't afford it. And I'm doing a UCLA internship right now and they're paying me. And so I finally had money. And on Halloween, I was like, okay, I told my little sister, Julie, like, let's go to Spirit Halloween and I'll get you a costume. So I took her to Spirit Halloween and there was barely anything left because it's Halloween, you know? But she finally found something. And we were in the line and I got her it. In the corner of my eye, I could see this mom and this kid arguing with the cashier. She had gotten him a costume, but it didn't fit and she wanted to like return it or exchange it. And she was basically telling the worker that Like, she had been saving up all year to finally give him a good Halloween. And you could tell she had obviously just come home from the fields. She still had the outfit. You could see the stains on her shirt from, like, the strawberries and picking the strawberries. And I saw it, and it broke me inside. I was trying really hard to let it go. You know when you cry, you kind of get that eye drop in your eyelashes before you, like, really start crying. I saw that in that little kid, and I could, like, not stand it. Like, my body, like, completely shut down. And I went to her and I told her, I was like, it's okay. Like, I'll get him the costume. Like, don't worry, you know? And she started crying and he was crying. Later, I found out that his name was Kevin, and she was telling him, like, Kevin, hurry up and find the costume. This kid has to go. Eventually he found the costume, and then the mom asked the little kid to get my number, and then I gave it to him, and then he called me the next day. Well, he said, thank you for the costume. And he told me how it was his first real Halloween, and how he had a good night trick-or-treating and everything. And I still hear that voicemail to this day, you know? And then that night, I started really thinking about everything and my past and every other kid out there. And I started watching every documentary I could and watching every movie I could about Cesar Chavez or Dolores Huerta, and I started reading all the books and articles I could possibly find. And over the next, like, week or so, I just started writing in my notebook everything, just different ideas, different strategies that people had used. And I went to one of my teachers, Mr. Villegas, and I asked him, what dream of a dream is too big? And he was all like, Caesar, I'm scared where this is going. But no dream, because I'd talked to him about things before. And then I told him, I was all like, I want to fight for fieldworker pay and rights. And here's the Kevin's project. And the really, I guess, goal for it, obviously, to increase fieldworker pay, but to really tell the stories of fieldworkers. And specifically, the way we're pushing it is the youth impacted by the fieldworkers. Like, I recently went to an elementary school to speak at one of my old classes. And this kid, he was 9. He was all like, guess what I'm going to be doing this weekend? I was like, what? He's like, I'm going to work with my dad. And I knew when he said that what he meant. And, like, my body broke down again. And I asked him, what do you mean? Where are you going to go work? He's like, I'm going to work in the fields. I'm going to go work in the strawberries with them. And then that's when I asked, how old are you? He was like, 9. And then, like, 3 other kids raised their hands and were like, I'm going to work with my dad too. And then they're like, I'm 9, I'm 10. And so seeing that, knowing that those kids have to, like, bend over and pick up the strawberries and carry the boxes too, has been keeping me going. This work, you know, no matter what the work is, it's a lot of work.
So right now, what are you working on for the Kevin Project, and what are your next steps?
Well, for that, since it's a very early, it's a very early steps of the campaign. We don't have the budget. We don't have the mass amount of support yet. You know, everything is really just us planning. We're going to spend the first year and a half. Well, hopefully not the half, hopefully just a year, really setting the intentions, knowing who the villains are, the vision, and just knowing really what we want to do. And it's going to be entirely youth-led. Everything's going to be youth for youth, the stories of the youth. And it's going to be a whole year of this whole year. It's going to be workshops teaching the youth their rights, their parents' rights. And then once we kind of establish that relationship of all of us knowing what's going on, then planning the actual campaign, you know, as far as we can. Our first big step is to film a documentary telling the stories of specifically youth, of them talking about how it was being raised by parents of field workers, or how it was joining them on Saturdays or during summer, working in the fields, and their stories and their tragedies, and their wins, you know, if they had any. From there on, obviously there's a big time jump We want to have a march entirely led by youth. Obviously, we're not going to stop any adults from coming, but there's this march in history where it was thousands of youth, of kids, left school at the exact same time and marched for this big, marched to this big city. And my big dream and our big dream with the Kevin's Project is for every youth in Santa Maria to be marching across Santa Maria. You know, every corner you see, there's a kid with a sign fighting for their parents and hopefully fighting for their future so that they know that they don't have to work in the fields, or that every person that comes across the border doesn't have to struggle when they get here. Because usually my parents are immigrants, and you know, a lot of people who work in the fields are immigrants. They come here to find a better life. And then that better life is just working every single day, all week long, for very minimal pay, which does not support them or their family. So that's our big goal, you know, making sure no kid has to feel that. And so it's going to be the documentary. It's going to be the march. And then obviously a lot of marches, and then hopefully for our first win with increasing field worker pay. And then after that, there's a lot of other fights of the quality of the fields. I know my parents have had to struggle a lot of the things even Cesar Chavez fought for, a lot of the things that he tried to implement, and fight, and wins during his era are now losses during my era, where he was fighting for like better water quality and actual bathrooms. And it was barely until last year where bathrooms and good water was implemented in the fields where my mom worked. And it's been, 80 years now or so since Cesar Chavez started that fight. And my mom barely got to use a bathroom last year during all this.
I'm so sorry to hear that. It makes me think, why do you think things like that keep happening to the workers? Like, why are bathrooms not being implemented, and why are people not getting clean water still to this day?
I think, at least from the point I see it, it has a lot more to do than just people not checking up on it. They're very unrepresented. They also necessarily can't fight for themselves. I know my mom has told me, like, yeah, people aren't going to show up to the march, Cesar, because they're scared of getting fired. You know, they're not going to strike and not work in the fields because who's going to pay rent? So a lot of it is they can't necessarily fight for themselves without having to lose that ability to pay for rent or pay for the food or pay for clothes, you know. And a lot of it, too, is that people definitely take advantage of field workers. I know just recently, maybe 2 weeks ago, my dad, he got a paycheck, and it said that he didn't get the full 8 hours because he supposedly left 30 minutes early, which means it was only part time for him and not the full time. So he didn't have to get that full time paycheck. And he was on the phone all weekend long with different organizations, trying to fix and trying to see what he can do. And there's not a lot of options, you know, not for field workers, not for immigrants, especially. There is not a lot of options. There's not a lot of people who are willing to stand up for them. So it's a lack of power, it's a lack of knowledge. My parents for a long time didn't know what they could have, what they couldn't have. It's a lot of taking advantage of, you know, and I think it's a lot of systemic racism that gets passed down, from all the different corridors of the official buildings, which are allowing this to happen.
Now I'm really curious to hear, like, how did your friends react when you told them your plans for your organization?
Well, it all started with, I guess, a text message to one of my friends, Lily. It was, I think, 10 or 11. And I was like, I have this crazy idea. She was like, okay, Caesar, I'm scared. I've gotten that response a lot because I think I scare a lot of people with my dreams. And I was like, I want to start a program. And then I sent her a voice message basically being like, this is what we do. And back then it was just the educational workshops, because there's three different subsections to my group. To my organization, there is the educational workshops. And this year it's going to be 3 times a month, teaching a wide variety of skills that schools wouldn't necessarily teach because of background. You know, we've done things like carpentry, entrepreneurship, bike repair, finances. And that was the start of it all. We just got a $10,000 grant, thanks to the Fund for Santa Barbara, to continue this work out throughout this year. It was like so much writing and so much discussing, but it's definitely worth it when you come out with a check of $10,000 to continue the work you're doing.
What is it called again?
La Cultura del Mundo.
Well, Caesar, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, of course.
This conversation has been really lovely.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, the San Luis Obispo International Film Festival begins on April 25th. And correspondent Tom Wilmer speaks with the festival's executive director, Skye McLennan.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from downtown San Luis Obispo. Come along and join me with Skye McLennan, Executive Director of the San Luis Obispo Film Festival. How cool.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me. It's our 30th anniversary this year. And yeah, the festival takes place April 25th through the 30th. We also have an encore in Paso Robles, May 1st through the 5th.
So you have in-person viewing in both San Luis Obispo and Paso, but then you have this whole virtual event too, so you don't have to physically be there.
Yeah, that was actually something that came out of the pandemic, was we realized we were actually one of the first festivals in the world to throw up all of our films online.
Wow. And was that kind of just random?
Well, the actual shutdown happened that week, and we had all the filmmakers were supposed to come, and just like the world started shutting down. And we reached out to the filmmakers and we just said, hey, we really still want to share these films. Do you mind if we throw them up on the website? And they were cool with it. It was just, you know, kind of a quick and dirty site, and the pass holders were just so appreciative, and the people that wanted to attend the festival, because they still got to experience that in the midst of kind of all of this chaos. What came out of that is we realized that there was still a lot of interest in the films virtually, and it really expanded our audiences to people outside of San Luis Obispo, and also people that just can't travel here, or, you know, for certain like disabilities. So really trying to make the festival as accessible as can be.
And how did you put the word out, and what was the response? Was it pretty viral?
Yeah, it was super popular. And now after we went virtually, a lot of festivals followed suit, and the technology greatly improved, because at the time it was only like the major streaming platforms that would even be able to facilitate something like that. So yeah, it became accessible to other people to use it.
So the film festival across the country, different festivals, it's really an entry port for indie film producers. Yeah. It's in some respects their only chance of getting into the sunshine.
Yeah, film festivals are a great place to see just some incredible films. As you know, now we have all these streaming platforms and things, and there's a lot of content out there, but I really see film festivals as curators of art. And so you're coming to see what we've deemed the best of the best out there in independent film. And you're going to see films that you might not see in a mainstream theater, or you might not see on Netflix. And what really adds to that is that these films are just, they're just as worthy as any of those other big films. So
there are films that made their debut, like right here at the San Luis Obispo Film Festival, and just blew up and went viral, and probably were then on Netflix or whatever,
right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a couple of our films have done that. Like, there was Fire of Love, which was our opening night documentary about these two volcanologists. That one went on to be nominated for an Academy Award, and it was so moving to audiences here in SLO and beyond. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
And for the old dogs, mm-hmm. a classic was the Blackberry or yeah. Crackberry.
Yeah.
And that, tell us a little bit about that. That happened here, right?
Yeah, we showed that one for opening night as well. And that one went on to be written up in the New Yorker and be really highly reviewed. It was about the history of the guys who made the Blackberry phone. And actually at the point of when the iPhone came out. Mm-hmm. It's a funny and very sad tale, actually. But yeah, it was something a lot of people didn't know about. And it was just such a great film. And throughout the whole festival, people were like, oh my God, did you see this movie? And then, yeah, it just went on to do really well after that as mm-hmm. well.
Talk about the curation process for a moment.
Generally, what happens is we receive over 1,000 submissions, submit on their own to the festival, and we do actually, the majority of our films are from submissions, which is unlike a lot of other festivals, some of the bigger festivals.
How would it differ?
I would say that some of the bigger festivals don't always show the submissions. They it's more insider network. For us, we're really like reaching out more if we feel like there's something topically that we know is going to be playing, would play here, really well here in SLO mm-hmm. and for our festival. And so we'll reach out to certain films, and I'll go and attend other festivals and make sure that we're also getting kind of the latest and greatest as well. So it's a really nice mixture of films that have played other festivals and then all, yeah, that have been submitted as well.
And then there's a prize, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody that submits might win first place under a given category.
Yeah.
Who votes on that?
So every year we have a jury that goes through all of the eligible submissions and our official selections, and they come up with the winners for that. So we have our George Sidney Independent Film Competition, and through that there's the best narrative, the best documentary, best short film, narrative short, best documentary short, best animated, and student, I believe. And then we have our Central Coast Filmmaker Showcase, which is just centered around filmmakers from the Central Coast, Santa Barbara, Monterey, and San Luis Obispo counties. And we
that's a category in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we have prizes within that. So this year, though, on our jury, we have Josh Brolin is on the lead of the jury, narrative feature jury.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. Correspondent Tom Wilmer is speaking with Sky McLennan of the San Luis Obispo International Film Festival, which begins later this month.
This is the International Film Festival, so it's not just Central Coast, it's not California, it's the world. Mm-hmm. So you have people from overseas that submit to you, right?
Yeah.
Talk to us about some of your favorites.
So I think that's a huge thing, especially in a small area, is bringing the world to San Luis Obispo is mm-hmm. kind of like what I like to say, especially we don't see a lot of foreign cinema these days. There's a film called Queen of My Dreams that I really love, produced in Canada, but it mainly features Pakistan in the 1960s. This woman goes back and kind of follows the journey of her mom and how her mom and father met. It's just visually stunning, and it's just beautiful to see this other part of the world. The other film would be Mountain Boy, which is all shot in the United Arab Emirates. It's about a boy with autism who kind of goes on this adventure. It's a family film, and it's also a really beautiful, I think, portrayal of the Middle East, which we just, you know, we're always seeing like the war and all those kinds of things, but you really see the landscape and just the beauty of that region. Mm-hmm. So we have a number of documentary features. We've got a film called 1,000 Pines, and it's about these men who come from Mexico on a work visa, and they actually plant pine trees, commercial pine trees, in the United States. And it's kind of cinema verite style. You're just hanging out with them in the fields, learning. You get to know them. You get to love them. Mm-hmm. A job I didn't know anything about. I had no idea, you know, that this was even a thing. And that's kind of where what I love about documentaries is, like, you get a portal into a life or part of the world that you didn't know anything about. What I love about this movie, too, is that you just get to know these people and how hard they work as well, just for a better life.
Mm-hmm. and a preview, one of your favorites that we'll be able to see.
I really love this movie actually called Tokyo Cowboy, one of our narrative feature films. And it's about a man who, he's from Japan, a Japanese businessman, and he's a farmer and specifically raises Wagyu beef cattle. And this other business decide to buy land in Montana in the United States and raise cattle for Wagyu. Well, he comes to find out that he can't do that, or they've bought the land, and he goes there and these farmers from Montana are like, well, you can't even grow corn here, and like, you need corn for Wagyu. It just is like this kind of quirky and sweet, like, overall just amazing. Like, I just love the juxtaposition with the South and this guy. And yeah, it's just a great movie. Mm-hmm. So it kind of hits all those, checks all those boxes.
Back to the film festival itself and attending. You have a whole smorgasbord of different tickets. Somebody wants to see it all, do it all. You have that. But you also have like a student or somebody that has to be more surgical in what they can afford and how much they can attend.
Yeah, I'm really all about making sure that there's kind of something for everyone is what we like to say. So we have an all-access pass that gets you into all the special events, all the screenings, our festival lounge. And that's $350. It's called the Movie Mogul. We have a Movie Star Pass that just gets you into regular screenings. That's more if you just want to see films. Mm-hmm. That's $225. And then we've got what we call little fan packs, a fan pack 8 and a fan pack 6. And these are just ticket packages that save you a little money on individual tickets. And then if you just want to see one or two things, you can buy individual tickets across all of the films. And so, yeah, there's no excuses to experience it. I know sometimes there's like gatekeeping with passes, but yeah, we have, it's kind of all options are there.
And so the go-to place to choose and to sign up and pay for your tickets is on your website?
Yes, our website is slowfilmfest.org. That's slowfilmfest.org. Mm-hmm. You can purchase tickets there, view our program guide, get all the information you need.
And a moment about Sky in your world. You were born and bred in the Hollywood and the theater world.
Yes. My dad was an actor, so I grew up in the industry a little bit. Grew up in Templeton, though, so a little far away from it. Mm-hmm. But I loved movies from a very young age and knew at very early on that I wanted to be involved somehow in film. When I left for college, I went to San Francisco and I studied film there. And what happened there was that I wanted to network and meet people. So I started volunteering at the San Francisco International Film Festival. And I fell in love with it. It was such a kind of like a magical energy and buzz. Mm-hmm. And to be a part of something like that was really amazing. And networking and meeting people. And so I got the bug for that. And then I kind of went up the ranks there. I worked at other film festivals in SF, including the Jewish Film Festival and the Asian American Film Festival. My dad's Australian, and I had always wanted to live over there. And so I moved to Australia, and I was working in film there doing production design. But I started working for the Sydney Film Festival. And the Sydney Film Festival is a little over 70 years old. It's one of the largest in the world.
Probably one of the older, too. You
know? Yes, yeah. And so it was such a big beast of a festival, and I learned so much, and I worked there for 5 years. And then I moved back, and I met Wendy, who was the former director of the Slow Film Festival. Mm-hmm. She had done it for 17 years.
Did you work for her when you came on board?
Yeah, we kind of like basically, I worked under her as her associate director, and then we started the transition. It was a natural fit, and I feel really honored to bring what I know or what I experienced in the rest of the world to my hometown, and to be doing this at home feels really special.
And so you took over the reins, what, in 2020?
Yes.
Right, yeah. Just in time for COVID?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's been a journey. We've just constantly been adapting and trying new things. And I'm really, this year, I'm probably the most proud of the program because We've just been through so much. And our willingness to try new things, I think, has really been exciting. And people have been very responsive to it.
So. Really interesting. Here it is, 2024. And you and some other people, they are still Cal Poly Arts director.
Yeah.
She said she's still recovering her kind of fan base pre-COVID.
Yeah.
And that's even you guys. You're not back to square one yet.
Yeah, Molly and I have talked about that before.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah, yeah. A lot of us kind of, there has been a lot of change in the arts within SLO, but it's really exciting time, though, at the same time. It's like, it was a bummer to lose those audiences, mm-hmm. but I'm seeing it come back and new people come into the
There
film.
You go. Reset.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. To learn more, where somebody wants to log on and dig deep, where would they go?
Go to slowfilmfest.org. That's slowfilmfest.org. And my name is Sky McLennan, and I'm the executive director for the San Luis Obispo International Film Festival, and we can't wait to see you there.
Awesome. I'm ready. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from downtown San Luis Obispo at the Cal Poly Innovation Center.
This is KCBX Public Radio, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. Up next, Working Lunch.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jim D'Antona, CEO for the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and your host today, and this is the Working Lunch. The SLO Chamber has formed a direct partnership with KCBX to bring you these Working Lunch discussions. Each month, we will sit down and meet with a member of our community to talk about doing business on the Central Coast. We're bringing you conversation with folks who are doing interesting things and impacting the business community that will help them meet the challenges of our current business environment. We hope you will join us for these conversations every month on KCBX Issues and Ideas. Today, I'm so pleased to be sitting with Ken Trigero. Ken is the Chief Executive Officer and President for People Self-Help Housing. People Self-Help Housing is a nonprofit housing developer dedicated to creating permanent supportive housing for low-income, special needs households. Hello, Ken. Thanks for being here today.
Hey, Jim. Hello to everybody. It's a pleasure to be here.
So People Self-Help Housing was formed in 1970 in response to the landmark federal legislation of the Fair Housing Act in 1968. It was clear at the time that there was a clear lack of housing being provided for those low-income and special needs households. So a group of concerned community citizens got together and helped put this organization together. Since that time, People Self-Help has built a substantial development portfolio, providing housing to over 10,000 individuals at this point. So, Ken, let's start out with a little bit about you. How did you end up in the nonprofit housing development community? Is this the passion you had in college, or did you jump right into this world, or did you take kind of a circuitous route to this line?
Yeah, I'd go with circuitous. I started out, and I'm a native to San Luis Obispo County, and so I went to Cal Poly to get my undergraduate degree. I was in ag business then, and that was a long time ago. A lot of folks were into ag back in the day. It was a good thing to start into. I transitioned into some other stuff. You know, I went up into the Bay Area and got another master's in finance. But I ended up working for a grower. And, you know, we had needs to house farm workers. That's really how I kind of got started. I was, you know, as CFO for the company at the time, trying to figure it out. What do we do? I was buying mobile homes. I was putting them on farms. I was trying to, you know, do what I could, but it was a super challenge. And what happened for me that really was a light bulb that went off is an affordable housing developer came to visit our company that I was working with at the time, and we had property. This was in San Jose. It had been farmed a long time back, but the family that I worked for converted it over to other uses. But there was this 10-acre parcel in the middle of San Jose, and this developer wanted to do affordable housing on part of that land, and the owner said, I have no idea what these people are talking about. Can you, talking to me, figure this out? So I looked over the shoulder of the project manager, and I figured out that they were doing affordable housing. And sometimes they do this for farm workers specifically. And man, I was like, oh, wow, there's folks that do this. Tell me more. Long story short, I moved my family back to the area. Thankfully, that was about 2004. And People Self-Help Housing was advertising for a position. I said, I think I kind of get how this works. They took a chance on me. And so that's how I really got into it and have never looked back. It's been a really rewarding experience.
How amazing. Yeah, and it's one of the, you know, especially in California and any, I'm sure, any of the grower states, farm worker housing is one of the hardest things to develop because usually you're pretty much in the middle of nowhere, right? You don't have those urban development pieces that are all coming together.
Yeah, that initial model that I saw is very similar to what we're doing today. You know, we use a lot of different financing sources, but they're really related back to those original programs. And over time, you know, they've developed a little bit differently. But right now, what we're doing today is very much in line with what started out in terms of a model. It's just amazing how it actually all works. And so I'll be happy to tell you more as we go through.
Yeah, let's kind of dig into some of that because People Self-Help does affordable housing. And I know sometimes that can just be a general term for housing someone, right, who can afford a house. But there's actually a legal definition, correct, of what affordable housing should mean in state law, in municipal law. Can you define some levels of affordable housing?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's for sure the point. And that's a good starting point to really define, because you hear this term affordable housing all over the place. What really does that mean? When I'm really talking about it is really, as you say, driven by some laws that have happened, and that translates into regulations for some of these programs. HUD is out there, the Housing and Urban Development Department at the U.S. government, and they define a lot of this. And, for example, when we talk about low-income households, they define that, and we define that as those who are earning 80% of the area median income and below. And then they use the term sometimes very low income, and that really is defined as 50, those households who are earning 50% of the area median income. And every year that changes, and HUD is doing these surveys throughout the nation to figure out what that is, and they do it by county. So every year we learn from when that's published what, for San Luis Obispo County, the area median income is. And so we peg everything to that. But further into the definition, really critical is what we say affordable is, means whatever the household is earning, and that's different for different folks, obviously, whatever they earn, the rent or a mortgage if we're doing home ownership shouldn't be more than about 30 or 35% of that income. That then is truly affordable to that household. So we're trying to figure out, you know, who we're going to serve, what they're making, and how do we make the housing cost to them no more than 30% of their income. It ain't cheap to build. It's not about low cost housing to develop, but to the end user. That's what we're talking about and focus on.
And even when we're not talking about affordable, in general, you should, you know, in theory, only have 30 to 35% of your household income going to your rent, your mortgage, or whatever. You know, you can see that people can have so much of their income taken up. So it's wonderful that they're creating these opportunities where people can pay the right amount and, right, potentially save some to maybe move on or do the next, take it to the next step, right?
Exactly. Yeah. If you've got, you know, 30% or something going toward housing, as you said, you still got a bunch of other expenses, but hopefully you can set aside and save, like for a down payment, if that's the goal, to get into homeownership. But barring that opportunity, you know, how else can you save? It's really not possible for a lot of folks, especially those in the lower income categories.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio with Issues and Ideas, Working Lunch. Host Jim D'Antona is speaking with Ken Trigero of People Self-Help Housing.
The crazy part is when we talk about very low income, in the SLO County, they could be working full time, right? Like in a minimum wage job, making $30,000, $40,000 a year,
right?
And still be considered very low income.
Oh, yeah. The current rate right now, the area median income for the county here, household of four, of course, it depends on how many people you have because multiple jobs are possible, but that's at $115,000 right now. And so we're serving folks who are closer to usually about no more than about 60% of the area median income. That's at about $70,000 right there. That sounds like a lot of money, but you just can't afford too much around here.
Still. Yeah, $70,000 for a family of four.
That's who we're talking about.
And we're and we're dealing with legal affordable description. Obviously, one of the key from the slow chamber side, we love our partnership with People Self-Help Housing because you're really working on making sure our workforce, we have a community that can stay here and be here. But we've really got to find a way to make it somehow our housing a little less expensive.
Amen. Because, you know, those who we're serving are predominantly frontline essential workers, as we now call them, right? Because we've experienced, you know, how valuable they are. So we got to figure that out. That's a critical part of our community and makes us sustainable in the long run. So yeah, it's everybody's job to figure that out.
And you're never going to fit, again, your economy is never going to be doing all it needs to if the only people you have can afford $1 million+ homes, right?
Then, totally agree.
Yeah, you need all levels. So let's talk a little bit about nonprofit housing development for affordable. It's a complicated process. I've spent some time around it. For a normal for-profit housing, you know, you go to investors or banks to fund the development. Affordable housing goes through a nonprofit entity. It's a lot more complicated. Can you talk about when you're trying to develop an affordable housing project as a nonprofit developer? What are the primary ways to maybe even finance an affordable development?
Yeah, that's the big difference. You know, every bit of development is very similar for nonprofit affordable housing versus market rate, except for the financing. That's the real difference. And you could imagine, because the crux, if we're talking about multifamily apartments for rent, for example, your rents aren't going to be too high, yet your costs are high to build that thing. So you need a bunch of money, a bunch of capital, and capital costs money, usually for market rate developer, right? But what we've got to do is find super cheap or even free sources of equity to build stuff. Now, we might be able to do, just as a market rate developer does, have a small loan financed through an excess of rents that cover not only the operating expenses, but leave a little bit of margin so we could have a loan to pay. But that's very small, very small. So we don't normally have too much debt. We just can't take that on at a property level. But there are some resources around. We probably usually have about 5 or 6 different sources in each deal. A primary one is through this low-income housing tax program that's been around for a while. That's really a great thing.
What is that? And once you get those credits, how do you actually use them to finance a project? It's a credit, so it's not like cash, right?
Yeah, this is the real magic. And this is really fun to talk about because, you know, it's just amazing how it all works, even though it's, as you said, so complicated. The program has been around, though, since 1986. Reagan Tax Reform Act is where this thing was born. So it's had a proven track record. It's had a lot of bipartisan support over the years because it creates a public and private partnership. So here's how it works, basically. It is an allocation. Federal tax credits is where it starts every year. It's about $2.65 for the main program for every person in the state. So every state gets an allocation. And so if you multiply that, you know, times the number of people, that's what we're able to hopefully get as a state. I mean, we do get as a state. Hopefully we get it for our community is where I was going. But there's not quite enough of it. So it is competitive. But anyway, we'll go if once we have a project that we're ready to, that's approved, it's shovel ready, as they say, just need money. We'll go to the state and we'll say, we've got this project and we'd like an allocation of tax credits. They'll see if it checks the boxes for what the state thinks are priorities, you know, according to their plan. And if we win an award, we get basically a piece of paper that says whoever has this piece of paper is entitled to these tax credits. That doesn't do us any good because it's just a piece of paper yet. But what we do essentially is sell it to an investor. Pretty much it's banks these days who really love to invest in these. And there's kind of two reasons for that. One is, you know, it's a real yield to them, if you will, not in terms of we're not going to pay them a dividend of any kind, or it's not a loan and there's no interest due. But what happens is they have profits and they don't want to write a check to the government for that. They'd rather keep that in their business, create more jobs, do whatever they're going to do. So in exchange for that piece of paper, they will write us a check to the property through this arrangement of a limited partnership, and they get the savings on their taxes, which is equivalent of getting a yield back to them on that capital investment. Plus, it satisfies their regulators who are making sure that, you know, they're investing in the community in lower income communities and households. So it's the Community Reinvestment Act that they need to comply with specifically. So it's just this great thing, complex, but it actually works. And because that is a cheap source, you know, for the property, because we don't owe any dividend back to that investor or interest, that money stays there forever. They're getting on the other side the tax relief every year to be that equivalent. And so, again, that's the magic ingredient, really.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio with Issues and Ideas. Host Jim D'Antona is speaking with Ken Trigero of People's Self-Help Housing.
You know, maybe you could talk a little bit about, because you said there's competition, right? You get 40 million people to, you know, 100 million in tax credits that comes through our state. But San Luis Obispo has to compete with Chico on these affordable, because everyone wants to do these affordable housing projects. So how do you compete? How does the state look at all that?
Good question. Yeah. More specifically, who we're competing with are others in the Central Coast region and the state. That's one way we're competing. We're competing in that region that the state defines as everybody in Santa Cruz down through Ventura County. It's a big area, and so there's a lot of competition. So the state sets aside a pool of those allocated tax credits for that specific region. But some of our jurisdictions throughout San Luis Obispo County and the Central Coast are deemed rural, and the state has a rural definition. And so if we're not competing with others in the geographic set aside, then we're competing with others that have this same rural designation throughout the entire state. And so that might be a Chico, for example. And so there's a lot of competition, you know, in both of those categories. The way we compete, one of the ways is if our community has these resources available, money, I should say, the city or county or what have you, to commit to a project at some level, you know, maybe it's not a huge amount, but the state says, oh, great, that says that your community is committed to this. They're putting some skin in the game, some financial resources. And that also means we're going to ask less credits because some of that is going to be funded locally. That enables the state to spread those credits, you know, over many, many more units. That's the goal for them. So that is a really helpful way to compete for these funds. Yeah.
Yeah. You hear about that occasionally from, you know, cities and counties talking about their affordable housing funds. Right, right. And we've heard, you know, whether it's yourself or someone like Haslow or Housing Authority of Paso, the cities and counties are putting money into those, and then you're going and getting those tax credits, and that's giving you some leverage, right? To go get those credits, which now you can sell to someone who needs them, and then that finances your project.
Exactly. And so fortunately, we've got some of those things going on, and there's more, I think, interest to see if we can expand on those. For example, you mentioned the Housing Authority, the city Housing Authority, the one that's in the city, San Luis Obispo Housing Authority, has a, well, on behalf of HUD, they administer the Section 8 program, and they do have the ability sometimes to allocate or commit project-based Section 8. And so that's just meaning it goes to the project, and that creates some rental assistance, and that helps us compete better, for one. So that's a local thing that we can get. And another example is the Housing Trust Fund of San Luis Obispo County has at least one loan product that the state considers a public resource. And so if we can get a commitment, even again, if it's a relatively small amount, it really has this leveraging power, as you're saying, to score more points ultimately on our application at the state.
Yeah, but the bottleneck to you creating more units is really about the financing, the money, right? If County of SLO found a pot of gold and were able to unleash that and put that into your developments, you could multiply that over the long term to do more affordable units for local workforce, everybody that needs them.
Exactly. And, you know, we accept pots of silver too. It's just, it doesn't have to be, you know, huge amounts. And my thought is, and I think a lot of others agree, is like, let's spread this around too and try to find, you know, little pots of gold, silver, platinum, whatever. Or I was meant to go down bronze. And try to figure out, though, where can we cobble together some resources and spread it across so we're not overburdening, you know, like putting our all of our eggs or hopes in one basket, if you will, too, because that doesn't seem to be like necessarily the best way to go. Another example, at the local level, some of the cities and county have offered to defer the development impact fees, for example. That's another source of financing, really. And so all those things really add up in this power of this leveraging.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio with Issues and Ideas, Working Lunch. Host Jim D'Antona is speaking with Ken Trigero of People's Self-Help Housing.
Getting the project develops a key part, obviously the huge part of providing the housing, but People Self-Help also has like services, right, for folks in your developments to help folks succeed,
right?
Is that part of the development process too?
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up because that's not only a part but a critical part of a lot of what we're doing in terms of trying to provide opportunities beyond just the sheltering of a house. I mean, that's job number one, of course. Get an individual or a family into an affordable housing unit of some kind. For example, we're trying to do our part to respond to those who are experiencing homelessness in all our communities locally here. And what we found to be a great success in over, you know, 700 households now, formerly they were experiencing homelessness. Now they've moved into our various properties, are in a much better place. But the way to get them into a better place is to try to help address some of those situations that they found themselves in that led to them becoming homeless. And so that has primarily been through the assistance of our staff who come under the umbrella of, we call them supportive housing service specialists. And they include licensed clinical social workers, for example, and others who are professionally trained to come alongside folks who have been experiencing homelessness and try to understand in their specific case what led to them becoming homeless and trying to figure out, like, well, how do we help you through that and make sure that doesn't reoccur? And so we, on a long-term basis, are there when needed, and, you know, we follow up and we help people just make sure they plug into resources that they may need. Again, it's common themes out there, but it's specific and unique to each person or household. And sometimes it's multiple things. You know, that's a common theme I hear. It's like you just have several unexpected events happen and here you are, you find yourself homeless. So that has been a really critical thing. Now, the other thing is that we're doing on services side for our kids who are moving in is a lot of cases we're able to, on the site of an apartment, new complex that has, you know, a common area, we'll build out a classroom, we'll build out a computer lab, we'll hire a teacher, and we have staff who have educational curriculum, and there's oversight, and we've got about 9 learning centers now on the sites of affordable housing complexes, and about 400 kids every year go through that program. We're helping them get into college. So that's kind of our theory of change. Like, those kids hopefully will get super good jobs, have higher incomes to be able to afford, you know, whatever is available when they're hitting the adulthood thing. So that is a critical program too. But there's not this same level of funding for those programs. So we're actually doing fundraising for a lot of that. We're pretty grateful that we have a pretty philanthropic community here, but we could always use more. That's always going to be a theme because, you know, populations grow and costs grow and we want to do more good, and it's every year. So that's a thing too we're working on always.
It's not just building a place, putting a roof over the head. It's building the support that's going to let them take the next step, get to that next level. Not just being a developer, you're also kind of providing social support and all of those things. You must have a varied staff, right? You got project managers, finance people, social support. This is a tough place to find people. Mm-hmm. and you're a nonprofit and doing really great work.
Yeah.
How have you kept a team together doing all this? Because you're doing a lot.
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's a varied team because our particular model is, you know, we're fully integrated, if you will. So we're the developer. We're our own general contractor. So we got, you know, staff that are trained there in that profession. And then we're our own property management company. So that's a whole different set of skills that we need. And we've got these services going on. So, we've got a bunch of people. I think we're up to about 240 employees now. How do we find folks and keep them? It's like a thing. And ironically, there's this affordable housing crisis that affects our employees too. But you know, we just try to be a really good quality employer. And so what we've done, and we so appreciate that we were recognized, at the Blue Diamond level as being a good place to work. And so I think the key things that helped us attain that have been having flexible work schedules. We've got like a 980 thing that people seem to really love. And we've embraced hybrid situations wherever we can. We do have some fully remote positions now too. And our health benefits are really good and above average, I would say, including, you know, extra dependent care. And we've got a good place to work. We're talking just a little bit about our headquarters building that we've finished a couple years ago. That's got some really healthy features and good features. It's a good place to work. You know, we've got, I don't remember what the system's called, but it's basically an ionization zapping the virus system in our air handling. So we're breathing good, clean air inside, and we've got touchless plumbing, trying not to share. I think we learned a lot through COVID, right? And that's when we were actually building this building. So we've been trying to be aware. And, you know, a fitness room there with equipment, with showers and lockers, and some of our folks like to bike in. So we've got lockers and a dedicated nursing room. All the things that I think people have said they really want, and good lunchroom sort of space. So that's how we do it, I guess, is trying to create a really inclusive culture that is sensitive to hearing what are people's concerns and having the ability for voices at every level to be raised and to be heard and to be acknowledged in our practices. So I think we've come a long way. I think it's going good because we find people and they're staying. So,
well, I'm sure you're doing incredible work for people throughout our county, and then you create this great place to work. We love hearing that. It's so great to hear how big People's Self-Help is, because this is not an issue that's going away. You're going to be doing work for a long time. And to our listeners, we could literally talk with Ken for 2 hours here on all the amazing work he's doing. But if folks want to learn more about your projects or how to get connected to those affordable developments, what's the best way to learn more about People's Self-Help Housing?
Yeah, it's really, I'd say, through our website. And, you know, it's our acronym for our name, People's Self-Help Housing Corporation. So that's PSHHC.org. And so I think that's pretty easy to navigate. And if you're looking for information on rental housing and developments or current properties, you can go there and figure out how to apply or follow up there. If you're interested in home ownership, we've got a place where you can find out about what's going on or get on an interest list to keep apprised and get on our list, because we send out a lot of information throughout the year. And so that's the best place to go to, I'd say.
Thank you so much, Ken, for joining us today and sharing some of your thoughts. To you, our listeners, thank you for joining us for this important conversation. On behalf of Ken Trigero of People Self-Help Housing, KCBX, and I'm Jim D'Antona for the SLO Chamber of Commerce, we hope you have an amazing week. Keep making our community a wonderful place to live.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.